Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, Suzanne Potter, Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thanksgiving's coming up next week, and that means the start of the holiday season. Retail stores will have you thinking it started in July, but it really only feels like Christmas when the network starts showing our favorite holiday films, Miracle on 34th Street, A Christmas Story, Elf, Bad Santa, and of course, It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life is about small-town America and how a good man, Harry Bailey, in a moment of despair, wishes he'd never been born. A guardian angel named Clarence helps Harry learn how much he means to other people, and in the end, good triumphs over greed and iniquity. We can all use a guardian angel right about now, but barring that, we still have the movie. And thanks to our friends at Fake Radio, the nation's premier all-time radio comedy troupe, we now have a live onstage production of the radio play. The only Portland performance of Fake Radio's It's a Wonderful Life takes place this Saturday, November 23rd, at the Multnomah Arts Center in Southwest Portland. We're fortunate to have Fake Radio's artistic director, David Koff, and cast member, actor, writer, producer, Jonathan Stark, here with us to preview the show. David and Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Ken.
Thank you.
Well, David, let's start with you. Fake Radio has a long history from its early beginnings in Los Angeles and now here in Portland as well. It's a little different than the usual live theater troupe, even a radio theater troupe. Can you tell us what listeners can expect at a Fake Radio show?
Well, I mean, we are anchored in history, so folks can expect legitimately to re-experience a radio broadcast from the late 1930s to the mid-1950s. Those are our sweet spots. We're taking the actual recordings. If we can't find a transcription, we are transcribing them, and then we'll represent them, including, and most ludicrously, all of the commercials that air. However, what sets apart what we do from just a straight-up radio theater troupe is the members of the cast come from the worlds of acting, singing, stand-up comedy, improvisation, and writing. So at unexpected moments, we go off script. And because a lot of these scripts are so dated and the language is so outmoded for how people speak today, there's a little bit of a loving parody aspect to what we do. And the actors will, when given a line that seems unusual or dated, have a little fun with it by going off script.
Yeah, some of that 40 slang.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, let's be honest, some of that slang was sexist. Some of that slang was racist. Some of that slang is, you know, language that we would never think to use today, either in a polite company or in the privacy of our homes. So this is what I mean when I say it's a little bit like a loving parody. We are, I think, introducing these wonderful pieces of entertainment history to new generations of fans by presenting them in ways that I think are a little bit more digestible to today's audiences. But people who grew up listening to Lux Radio Theater or the Mercury Radio Theater on the radio, you know, people that I would now consider to be my parents or grandparents' age, they'll love it because they'll be brought back to their childhood. And people like me will love it because they've heard about their parents and grandparents listening to this stuff, but never thought they'd be able to hear it in a way that more connects to who they are now at this present time.
And in a way, you're introducing it to a whole new generation. I know I talked to you about the youth collective at KABU, who just recently did a radio theater piece based on Dimension X, I think was the radio show.
Dimension X is a great sci-fi program.
And yeah. You said you work with kids too, teaching them radio theater.
I do, yeah. I get brought into high schools and I will bring scripts. I will cast them. We'll learn about technique when the students go up to the microphone. We'll work on how to prepare your character, but I'm also working with the folks on the producing end. So I've created a piece of software that allows the students to bring in the script and embed the sound effects. And so they learn about how to create audio files, how to engineer different sound effects, and then how to play those while their classmates are actually doing the acting at the mic. So it becomes a really lovely joint effort for, you know, on mic and behind the scenes.
Now let's get to your latest holiday production, It's a Wonderful Life. Last year, both of you did Miracle on 34th Street. So only a matter of time, David, before you took on this holiday classic.
Well, I mean, how many fantastic American holiday classics are there?
And maybe those two.
Yeah, I mean, they're both great. This was when I first joined the cast, which was back in the 1870s, this was the first show that I got to be a cast member in. And I thought it was so great. And it's still one of my most favorite shows to perform because of some of the things that make it an instant classic. It's an amazing Christmas story. It's not a straight up comedy. It deals with some pretty deep and unusual issues.
Like suicide.
Suicide, yeah. Angels, heaven. You know, these are not things that were discussed in polite society when this radio broadcast aired, which was in 1947, I think. And the history of this casting is really unusual. You know, Jimmy Stewart went off to fight in World War II. And by all accounts, he suffered badly from shell shock as a result of what he saw in war. And when he came back to Hollywood, he didn't want to work. And I guess Frank Capra approached him about this. And, the initial conversation with his agent was, no, Jimmy doesn't want to work. But when he saw the script and he saw that here is this guy who was so depressed that his own life hadn't become what he thought it should be, that he was considering suicide, he took the role. There's, I think, some pretty amazing things that needed to align for this project to come to be. And it plays out in Jimmy Stewart's performance, which is, from my perspective, iconic. How do you take a guy whose life is falling apart and make it into an amazing Christmas story?
Yes. You know,
Jimmy Stewart was an amazing actor. I can't think of a lot of people that could pull that off.
And he was also in that 1947 Lux Radio Theater version, which was a year after the film was released.
Exactly.
Along with Donna Reed. So yep. It's great that he played, and I think that's the transcript that you're using from that performance.
It is.
Now, Jonathan, when we talked about the fake radio cast coming from backgrounds in stage, film, TV, and sketch comedy, as David said, you check all the boxes. I think listeners know you as the co-creator of the TV series According to Jim with Jim Belushi, which ran 8 seasons, a lot on television. But yeah. What's your background in sketch comedy? You have some roots in the Groundlings?
I do. I actually was at the Groundlings last night watching a show. I started out at the Groundlings. I started out at the LA Connection many, many years ago. I think around 1878 when David started.
Right.
but I made so many friends there, and we all started taking an improv class with a guy named Bill Steinkellner, and we all became friends and kind of migrated to the Groundlings. And I was in the Groundlings for several years, and then I went and did a little theater, and I got cast in my first movie, which was called Fright Night. I did House 2 and some other films and Project X, and I decided I wanted to become a writer. You know, after that in overnight success of 2.5 years, I finally got my first job. And started.
Was that
out,
Cheers,
you
know, Jonathan?
Yeah, on Cheers. Yeah, and then I worked on Drew Carey and The Nanny and Bob Newhart, and you know, I just kept working. And then finally, we got our. Oh, and I wrote for Ellen for for 4 years.
Oh man, there's a separate interview right there, huh? What that must have been like.
Absolutely. I wrote for Ellen for 4 years and then got the Emmy, and then I did Corinne Jim. So I've been extremely lucky in this town. And
I like how John downplays that. Got the Emmy. He won an Emmy for co-writing the episode where Ellen came out on TV, which was this giant cultural moment in America. It wasn't just that he won an Emmy. It was for a particular episode that kind of captivated the public.
Oh, shucks, Dave.
Very, very important episode in television history and in the U.S. culture, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then I, you know, part of the fun of this is I got to work with fake radio, which was to me, David called me one time because we had known each other from doing improv together. And he said, hey, I'm doing this show over at the fake gallery. And would you come over and do a guest star? Now, he was scraping the bottom of the barrel here. So I was the guest star in this one. And I went and did, I think it was Dracula, I believe, for about 10, I think with 10 people.
Were you the vampire?
People. I think I was the lead. I think, I don't remember, it was so long ago. But I think 10 people and no air conditioning and hot as hell. And, you know, and people playing music outside. And, you know, it was just like, it was downtown LA somewhere, but it was so much fun. I said to David after, I said, look, I was a guest star this time. I'm not asking to be a guest star again, but I'm happy to just fill in if you need another voice. And he called me instead, and that's how I got involved with it. Now I get to go up to Portland and work with, first of all, I love Portland. It's amazing. And I love the rain, so I'm good. And I get to
work with. We got you covered. It's pouring today.
That's right. And I
you're in luck if you like the rain.
I we don't see rain here. And the last time I saw rain was March, I think. So I'm from Pennsylvania. So rain is my thing. But I get to work with a great cast as I do when we do shows in LA, which is another great cast. So it's a win-win for me.
And talking about guest stars, David, we mentioned Jonathan doing the Bela Lugosi role. You've often featured a prominent guest star like Jonathan. And in the past, I know you've had Phil Proctor at the Firesign Theater. That was for A War of the Worlds, in fact, you did up here. The Kids in the Hall, Kevin McDonald, Dave Foley, Mark McKinney, Lorraine Newman from SNL, Ray Romano, Fred Willard, Jeff Garlin, George Wendt, Marsha Wallace, all comedy all-stars. But this year, you experienced a few setbacks. You were originally going to get Cassandra Peterson, Elvira.
Yeah. This has literally never happened in all the years I've been bringing the show to the stage, but we lost first one and then two guest stars.
Julie Brown.
Yeah, we lost Julie Brown. We lost Cassandra Peterson. When I say lost, I mean they needed to cancel. They have busy and full careers, no disrespect. And, you know, it's not like what we are doing is this big production where I can pay hundreds of millions of dollars to my cast and crew and my guest stars. Largely, everyone does this out of the generosity of their heart. Because
wait a second. Wait, we don't get paid?
We can discuss it later, John. Ixnay on the ADO ready.
Okay. Right. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it has come to pass before, Ken, where someone has had a medical emergency. Oh, my kid's going to be, you know, okay, fine. We'll reschedule for another time. But in this case, both of the talented women who had said yes ended up booking films and needed to go into pre-production. So, all right, we'll do the show without a guest star this time. And as a lot of people from the cast have mentioned to me, the show is what's the star anyway. It's really fun to have, you know, some of my comedy and acting heroes join me. So, John, you'll just have to be my comedy and acting hero this show, along with Aaron, okay?
Well, I always knew I was your hero. I just didn't know comedy and acting, but...
Now, wait a second, David. You actually do have a guest star, Aaron Fitzgerald.
Yes. Well, it's a funny thing to say because Aaron's been in the cast for a considerable number of years, but like John, she has gone on to bigger and better and more acclaimed. She just got nominated for an Emmy Award last year for her voice acting. She's a top tier voice actor, and she's been on a show called Ask the Story Bots and got an Emmy nom for that, which is amazing. And, you know, Aaron had approached me, it's got to be 8 years ago, and we had just finished doing the Lux Radio Theater version of The Wizard of Oz, which we would do in costumes and make it a sing-along. It was always like a fun family event. And after the production, she approached me and she said, you know, I would like to do The Wizard of Oz too. And my response was, well, great, we just did. And she said, no, I mean by myself. And I said, well, but that's not possible. And she said, well, I'd like for you to direct it and maybe help me write it. And I said, it's definitely doable. Let's do that then. And so here we are about 8 years later. The show's been written. We have now brought the show to San Diego and Indianapolis and, of course, Portland and Los Angeles. And she's going to bring it back to Portland for one night. So after she stars in the Donna Reed role in It's a Wonderful Life, which is Mary Bailey, George Bailey's wife, she'll be the next night performing every single role in The Wizard of Oz in a one-woman show. And that'll be on Sunday night at the Judy Theater Complex in downtown Portland.
Oh, that's, yes, Southwest Broadway in downtown Portland. I read that she'll be doing 27 characters.
Yep, she's got 27 distinct characters. She's memorized 80 pages of dialogue.
Incredible.
She has internalized, I think it's either 15 or 18 different virtual sets in her brain because she's walking around the set and interacting with it, even though it's not really there. And no props, no costumes. It's just theater at its most primitive, and it's hysterically funny. And in much in the way that we approach our fake radio shows, she approaches that. So we used a lot of improvisation to modernize the story. The dialogue has been updated for new generations of fans, and funny things that people who watch the movie have probably asked themselves a million times. It all comes out in our version of it. It's a very, very funny show, and I've now seen it literally hundreds of times, and I always lose my lunch laughing. So
so it's a treat and a great opportunity for us here.
It is. Portland. I mean, look, it wasn't intended to be a rip-roaring comedy, but in our version, it sure is. And it's still delightful and lovely and warm and charming and a really fun family sing-along.
Well, David and Jonathan, thanks so much for talking with us today. Happy holidays to you both and the entire Fake Radio crew.
Thank you, Ken. Same to you and your family. And I appreciate you having us on KBOO as always.
Absolutely. Always great to see you.
We've been talking with David Koff, Artistic Director of Fake Radio, and actor, writer, producer Jonathan Stark. They'll be performing in Fake Radio's version of the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life from the original 1947 Lux Radio Theater broadcast this Saturday, November 23rd, 7:30 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center, 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. You can learn more about Fake Radio's Saturday show and purchase tickets in advance on their website, fakeradio.net. I'm Ken Jones with KBOO's News in Depth saying, Clarence, where are you when we need you?
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest story. It's called Multnomah County Considers New Requirements for CEI Hub Operators. A worst-case scenario could cost the county billions in damages. Local leaders and advocates want fossil fuel companies to carry the liability. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So this piece obviously covers a county ordinance to address the risks of the CEI hub. Folks at home may be familiar, maybe not. For folks who are unfamiliar, what is the CEI hub?
Yes, the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, commonly known as the CEI hub for probably self-evident reasons, it sits on the banks of the Willamette River. The companies that are there store or transport about 90% of all liquid fuels in the state of Oregon. That includes 100% of the state's aviation fuel used at the Portland International Airport and beyond. So there are a lot of risks associated there with both the transport of the fuel, but also a 2022 report from Multnomah County said that the hub being there really risks pretty catastrophic consequences to the environment and to human life and non-human life in the event of an earthquake. And as you likely know, the Cascadia subduction zone off the coast of the Pacific Northwest, it's a long fault line, 600 miles long, and is a bit overdue for a megathrust earthquake, which could cause pretty significant damages right here in our backyard.
Why is the CEI hub so risky? Like, what are the things that are built into that when we talk about an earthquake potentially happening?
People often say that the CEI hub isn't just in a bad place, it's in the worst possible place. So there's sort of endless risks. But in the event of an earthquake, the tanks that are there could be subject to liquefaction, basically meaning that the ground that they're on would liquefy and cause, it's sort of like if you imagine like sand on a speaker kind of bouncing up and down, it would create the conditions where those tanks might actually just leak into the river. They might explode. They may cause fires. It's roughly, I think, 1,300 or so feet away from Forest Park. So if they were to explode, that could cause really significant damages there. Leaking into the river, the county estimates, could cost $2.6 billion to clean up just from an oil spill. And that is a pretty low estimate, actually. It's also worth mentioning that the Willamette River flows into the Columbia River, which flows in the Pacific Ocean. And so there's a lot of concern about, the habitat in the Columbia River, salmon spawning. And it just is sort of endless. I could probably talk about that for a long time, and I don't think we have enough time for that.
That's fair enough. I will mention also that the tanks are very old and we don't know what's in all of them.
True. They were built an average of 70 years ago. Some of them were built more than 100 years ago when the CEI hub was first built in the early 1900s.
Okay, so we understand that there are some risks here, and of course, community members have been organizing about this for a long time. Now it's coming up for Multnomah County to do something about it. What is their plan?
So this would basically require these facilities. It kind of fills some gaps because it's not as if these companies don't have some sort of insurance for the kind of dangerous business that they're in. But it fills some gaps, basically saying that facilities have to provide financial assurances through a trust fund, insurance policies, a bond, letter of credit, or other mechanisms that prove that they would be able to handle and quickly the financial costs associated with a worst case scenario there. There have been examples in the past of delays, for years on end, even into decades, where, the taxpayers are essentially responsible for the cost of a cleanup that was caused by the fossil fuel company, even when there were some of these protections in place. So this is really trying to address some of those issues.
And the financial impact we're talking about is on the scale of billions, right?
Right, yeah. The low estimate of a worst-case spill is $2.6 billion, which in county money is real. That's a little different at a state or federal level, but obviously that would be pretty significant. And just to be clear, too, we'd be talking about this not... That's like a spill, but if there was an earthquake where it spilled and it was in the Willamette River and there were fires and bridges had collapsed or, any of these things which we are overdue for, you could really be talking about a really long-term cleanup process.
So this risk bonding strategy is what Multnomah County is going to attempt to pursue. How much of this type of work, how much of it is under county authority for them to go forward with?
I think there's a bit of a question as to whether this is something that would be included in a DEQ program, their fuel tank seismic stability program. that the legislature has actually used the Multnomah County report from 2022 to create. You know, the county has done a pretty decent job of trying to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for their actions and the risks that are associated with their actions, you know, including their lawsuit against major fossil fuel companies for their responsibility in the 2020-2021 heat dome. So they definitely have, you know, at least some jurisdiction. This is kind of something that's often done at a state or federal level, but again, those cause delays. There can be delays in receiving the funding, and so they're trying to address that to make sure that we're in an okay place if something does happen.
In your article, you also mentioned the Oil Pollution Act, and that both that act and state law contain an act of God provision that limits some of these things.
Right. There are some, there are some act of God provisions, and this might only, those things only apply to certain facilities and not all of them. So there are some little gaps there. It's interesting because an act of God provision, you know, what we're talking about here is, you know, pretty much by definition, one of those acts of God where the worst case scenario would likely be because of an earthquake. So the idea that they wouldn't be financially responsible for not upgrading their infrastructure to account for that is a little bizarre.
This risk bonding, is this a new idea?
I don't think it's a new idea. Just, you know, somebody who was giving public testimony the other day essentially said requiring these assurances isn't a new concept at all. It's nobody thinks twice about requiring renters to pay security deposits, you know, for damages in a rental unit. And then, you know, with specifically with regard to fossil fuel companies, like underground storage tanks, every gas station that has an underground storage tank of, you know, unleaded gas or whatever under their parking lot is required to have these kinds of financial assurances. I think what makes this a little unique is the scale of the damage that could happen in the worst case scenario. But just generally the idea that somebody who's operating, you know, a company that's operating for a profit, should be responsible for the liability if something goes wrong is not really new at all.
There's a mention in your article about how this sort of structure that the county is considering may incentivize businesses differently. Can you speak to that point a little bit?
Yeah, this did come up during public comments at a board meeting last week. Catherine Muller, a local scientist and educator, said that this can basically incentivize these companies to comply then with state requirements, which are again a bit different, you know. And also beyond that, there are a lot of federal requirements for oil companies like this. So just kind of having some levers and some teeth here to be able to, you know, have a bit of a carrot and a stick for good and bad practices.
Well, you mentioned the federal aspect, and of course, we're looking at a different presidential landscape now with a second Trump administration, one that has made some big claims about fossil fuel companies and energy companies generally. How might that play in? Is that a worry that is on folks' mind when it comes to the CEI hub?
It seems like holding fossil fuel companies accountable under a Trump administration seems a bit more challenging, you know, than things have been in the past. It is worth mentioning that, you know, President Biden also expanded oil here in the United States, you know, over the last 4 years. He also invested in a lot of clean energy, but I believe drilled more oil on U.S. soil than any country ever in the last 4 years. But Trump has been very explicit about, you know, wanting to be the number one producer of oil and natural gas globally. And he really wants to slash, you know, any restrictions on what fossil fuel companies do. And I think there is a bit of a, you know, a sense that, you know, local electeds like Multnomah County need to get these things in place now because it may become more challenging in the future.
So where does this stand now, this proposed ordinance? What's next?
This is going to the Multnomah County Board Thursday on the November 21st. That's the first reading of it. It did seem like from the first kind of information session that there appeared to be a lot of support for this. This isn't a really, this is sort of a nonpartisan issue. People don't tend to like massive earthquakes and oil spills and fires. After that, I believe it'll pass, it'll go to another reading after that and a vote.
What are some of the key takeaways that you hope folks get from this story?
I think that one of the main takeaways is, again, the CEI hub is not just built in a bad place, it's built in the worst possible place. And so there's a lot of effort. This is a real community safety issue. Of course, this isn't just the safety of people in the event of a worst case oil spill. The CEI hub, you know, Zenith Energy transports oil by rail through neighborhoods that disproportionately impact low-income people and people of color. The oil moves from there. It doesn't just stay there. It moves from there. It moves around the world. This is addressing climate chaos, which we see all the time. And this is just the kind of thing that can at least help to address and incentivize these companies to do things a little bit better.
If our listeners are interested in finding out more, reading your piece for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to read Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can find us at streetroots.org.
That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Multnomah County Considers New Requirements for CEI Hub Operators. A worst-case scenario could cost the county billions in damages. Local leaders and advocates want fossil fuel companies to carry the liability. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO.